Pete Yost here for the Unbuild It podcast with a word about our sponsor, Huber Engineered Woods. There are really three reasons why I think Huber Engineered Woods stands out, and it's a big part of why they're a sponsor of our Unbuild It podcast. First, they develop systems of products. The products are compatible and integrated. Makes our jobs a lot more easy in the field and when specifying. Second is superior tech support. There are really good website resources that they have developed for the application of their products, but they also have an outstanding 800 number tech team that really knows their stuff. And the last is a really active technical research and development team with whom I've done a lot of work over the years, and I have a lot of faith in the information I get from them when I have questions about product performance. So that's it. That's our high performance sponsor. Now onto the podcast.
I'm Jake Bruden, and welcome to the Unbuild It podcast. Steve is not with us today. I'm joined The thing is, he won't even listen to this to know if we make fun of him while he's not here or not.
It's still free space.
It is. Yeah. It's still free space. I'm not sure if he knows how to download it. If we're Who am I saying that to? Do you know how to download it, Pete?
Oh, sure.
It doesn't sound very believable. So if I'm only joined by Peter Yost, then that means that we must have a special guest. And today's special guest is actually Peter's older and wiser brother. Is that the way you would describe yourself, Nathan?
You're right on both counts.
Okay.
I'll just leave it at
we're,
that.
We're joined by Nathan Yost. And you may have heard Nathan before. We did one podcast with Nathan probably a year and a half ago.
Quite a ways back.
But let's let Nathan introduce himself and explain to us why he might be worth talking to today.
And should we say Dr. Yost?
That's yes, a good sorry. Lead-in?
Thank you and good morning. My background is multifold, but part of the reason I'm here today is I'm a retired pulmonary physician. But in addition to that, I worked as a building scientist with Peter at the Building Science Corporation, and then on our own with Steve at 3D Building Solutions. And so I happen to know quite a bit about the human body and lung disease and the effects of mold, and I know a fair amount about buildings, especially residential, but also mold in commercial buildings. So,
and tons of condolences. He has done a lot of work with Steve over the years.
Yeah, that's a noble thing that you've dealt with there.
Yes, but I was frequently his driver when we went on investigations together. And,
I mean, you took him in sleep form from place to place.
Well, one of the things you need to know is that Steve was extremely good about asking permission to go to sleep, because from his time in the Marines, if you were the shotgun rider, you had to make sure the driver stayed awake. And so he would always say, permission to go to sleep. Yep. And I'd say, please do it.
And since Steve is the youngest and has three or four sisters, he clearly thinks of Nathan as one of his older brothers. I don't know where I fall in all of this, but Nathan's clearly a strong figure for Steve.
If I had to guess, I would think that Steve probably thinks of you as older.
Not necessarily wiser, but older.
Duly noted. Duly noted.
If it helps, I think of you as older.
That helps just enormously. Yeah.
So Nathan kind of alluded to what today's topic is, and we wanted to talk about mold and specifically mold in buildings, but I have a feeling that's a more drawn out conversation that involves mold in general so that we understand. And I thought what we might do, because I'm a builder and the mold conversation comes up not as much now as it did, say, 10 years ago. I thought I would tell you how I talk to my clients about mold up front. Even if we're doing a renovation and we find mold, how the conversation goes, and you tell me where I'm wrong, where I'm right, and whether or not I need to clarify what I'm saying to clients. Does that work for you?
Sure does.
Okay, so my speech to clients is mold needs something to eat, something to drink, and a temperature to live in. So it has to be a hospitable environment. And to create that environment, we need temperatures that are close to where we're comfortable. we need something to eat, and our house is built out of all sorts of things to eat, and then it needs something to drink. And so we're not going to start living at 160 degrees or below freezing, and we're not going to rebuild the house out of nothing but, you know, antimicrobial concrete block. And so the only thing we actually have control over is the moisture. And so if we solve our moisture problems, our mold problems virtually disappear.
Yeah, I mean, I'd agree. I think that choice of materials and, of course, building methods are a huge factor in terms of how you put things together and essentially how you keep them dry. But the other thing I would add is that there's only so much you can do as a builder, because once you turn it over to the occupants, well, they are going to be responsible for what happens. So they need to have some understanding, but they also then they need to understand what they should and shouldn't do. But I think the other thing I would add is that if you're going to build with susceptible materials, which we do pretty much in terms of wood for framing, mm-hmm. and a lot of other things.
Paper-faced gypsum
board. That if you can't keep things from getting wet during the construction process, then you're going to have to allow them to dry out. But there is almost always, unless you're building in Arizona the last couple of years where there's been next to no rain, you're going to get some surface mold, especially on wood framing roof trusses. And there's no reason to panic over it.
So, Nathan, you just said surface mold. So I think a lot of people need to understand more about how mold grows. And so maybe how different it is from fungi growth.
Well, you just said something that's not accurate. Mm-hmm. Mold are fungi. We just happen to use different terms for when fungi are growing on a surface, such as fabric. We usually then call it mildew. Hmm. It is mold. It may be different species of mold. And then we got wood decay fungi that actually destroy wood. They don't just grow on the surface of it. They're all part of the same family. I'm forgetting my taxonomy here. Somebody correct me. But they're different, many, many different species.
Yeah.
And so different species prefer different materials, and they also prefer slightly different moisture conditions. So wood decay fungi, for example, need really, really wet conditions, whereas surface mold that we see on wood, wallpaper, behind wallpaper, on surfaces in basement, generally are not destroying those materials, but they are growing there.
So when we see, quote unquote, mold on the surface of something, are we looking at sort of all the parts of the mold or certain parts of the mold structure? You know, spores versus fruiting bodies? And
it would depend upon the species, and I don't want to be inaccurate in going into too much technical detail there. You are often looking at a mix, and whether or not the fungi are producing spores is going to depend upon the conditions, because the spores are essentially seeds, if you will. Mm-hmm. And just as trees don't make seeds all year round or depending upon environmental conditions, the same thing is true.
So in other words, I could discover mold growing inside the house, and it might not actually still be growing. If the conditions aren't favorable to that particular species at that moment, it's dormant, potentially?
Right. And that is often the case. When something got wet, mold grows, and then it dried out. The thing to remember there is that, especially in terms of the effect on allergies and people with asthma, whether it's alive or dead really doesn't make any difference, because the proteins to which people are allergic are there.
Can you go through sort of like the medical, not stages, but if can I have a reaction to mold that's not allergic? It's just sort of a response to a heavy concentration of spores or something.
Yes, but I'd sort of break it down too. It's like dust. Dust can cause coughing and sneezing if there's an awful lot of it, even if you're not allergic to things in the dust itself.
So it's a sort of a physical irritant as opposed to a chemical reaction or a biological reaction?
Right. I mean, it's just you're sort of, you can overwhelm the clearance mechanism.
Mm-hmm. And we're all different, so it's going to affect everybody slightly differently.
That's the thing to realize is, and we'll go through sort of the different things that mold can do, but we're all different. And so I always think back to the canary in the coal mine, that the reason they put a canary in the coal mine, as I understand it, is that the canary was more susceptible to carbon monoxide or other toxins than the workers were. But among the workers, there's great variability. And I'm just going to use one little anecdote.
You don't want it to be an anecdotal story like Steve tells?
Let's say.
I'll let you be the judge of that. It has to do with the petroleum industry. If you ask producers of petroleum and refineries, are their workers bothered by the chemical fumes that are there? And they say, oh, no, they're not. And if you go and survey the workers that are there, that's by and large true. But you're not asking the right question. The question is, how many people started working there and left after a day,
interesting,
a week, or 2 weeks because they couldn't stand the smell? Either because it made them feel sick or it just made them feel horrible. So you select in many circumstances people who are tolerant or intolerant. And that's the same thing to some degree in terms of of mold, that some people never develop an allergy to mold. Some people, when exposed to it over a period of time, become allergic to mold. And some people very early in life get allergic to a lot of things, and that's not completely understood. In the articles that Joe Steabrook, Terry Brennan and I wrote 20 years ago, almost to the day, Joe makes the comment that we don't know how long you need to be exposed or by how much to develop allergy or reaction to things. And that's true because there's so much individual variability.
Yeah. And is there like a third level, like people who are not just doing an allergic reaction, but have I don't know what you would call it, but more than an allergic reaction to mold? You know, you hear that about perhaps immune compromised individuals.
Well, there are two things that can happen. One is gets into more multiple chemical sensitivity, where people have reactions in some cases that are not well understood, that go beyond allergy. And that gets into allergy technically is when you produce antibodies to normally a protein. So a lot of people say they're allergic to something when you don't really know if it's a true allergic reaction, but it may cause them chest tightness. It may cause them other physical problems, but that's separate from infection. And so molds, fungi can cause infection, but most of those are not molds that grow within buildings. They tend to be in the soil. They tend to be in different parts of the country. So histoplasmosis is big in the central U.S. Coccidioid mycosis, which is also known as valley fever, is a problem in Arizona and some of the Southwest. And those organisms can actually cause illness and severe illness, but not in most people. And when you say, well, is it just people with altered immune systems? To a degree, but also some of it has to do with some individuals, even without a defined immune problem, are more susceptible to some things than others are. And it may have something to do with where they grew up. So if you grew up in the Southwest and you've been exposed to that fungus all the time, you have it get into your body, but you don't actually get infected.
So in a lot of my work, Nathan and I continue to do work together because of his expertise in building
morning walks.
Morning. That's right. Where we experience pretty high mold counts, the spore counts along the way. This question comes up a lot. You know, do I need to have a mold specialist company come and tell me what the spore count is and then culture and tell me which molds I have?
If the goal is remediation, right?
Well, quite often the first thing that a mold mitigation company will do is say, we need to come and do spore counts and see what types of mold you have. Okay. And that's fairly expensive. And I'm asking Nathan if that's a wise investment of their money.
No. In almost all circumstances, you don't need to know what it is. And furthermore, every dollar that you spend on testing for most people is a dollar they're not going to have for cleaning up or removing and replacing materials. In that, the articles that I was referring to, which are 20 years old, that are on the buildingscience.com website, one of them deals specifically with testing. And at the time we wrote it, there was much more testing being done than I think there is now. Because if you see mold, you've got it. If you've got wet conditions, you've got to deal with wet conditions. And I use the example, I don't know if people can see above us, there are ceiling tiles, which are made of a cellulose product. Why do they get put in? Two reasons. One is they're easy to remove for access to wiring. But the real reason is cheap.
Yeah.
But once they get wet, especially for building managers, they become a priceless commodity. No, we can't replace them. They're expensive.
I never thought about it like that before, but we did a ton of turnover stuff for a long time. And that's exactly what it is. It's like the cheapest thing in the world.
Right.
And they'd be like, well, let's paint it.
Yeah.
Let's spray paint those three with this Kills primer. We'll see if it's close to the same.
And I always say to people, what do you think those brown spots up there are? Do you think that's coffee that people have thrown up to the ceiling? Maybe in some cases, yes. But it's basically water from above, either condensation or a leak. And now suddenly it becomes too priceless to,
that's funny,
to repair. So are we going to test to see if there's mold there? Why bother? You can... buy 100 panels for the cost of a couple mold spore tests.
And unfortunately, I often get called in, and I'm sure you have too, where they've already spent the money and a lot of it to get the mold spore counts and mold identification. And then you're in the unenviable position like, well, thank you very much, but we really didn't need to know any of that. That's not easy to digest.
I can tell you by pointing at it and looking at it that's mold. Yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry if you're in that industry, by the way. We're not trying to disparage an entire industry.
There are some circumstances where you're going to do that. You're going to do it.
Nathan's backpedaling now.
No.
Just kidding.
You're going to do it in a cancer ward. Or a transplant ward. Because there, very low spore counts could be a real problem to someone who's getting radiation and chemicals to wipe out their immune system before they get a transplant. So there are circumstances, although you also combined with that are doing things in the building in terms of controlling airflow and pressures. Mm-hmm. But in general, if you see mold, you've got mold.
And there's one solution.
There's one solution.
Yeah.
You either clean it. If it's on a surface, a hard surface that's not easily replaced, or you replace the material. And there are things that you want to be careful about when you are the person removing the material in terms of protecting yourself. And you say, well, why do you need to do that if the mold's not a problem? Well, when you're removing materials that have mold on them, your potential exposure is huge.
Because you're aerating.
Because you're aerating and you're doing it constantly. So some of the really bad cases that happened, this is going back probably 30 years, it was a owner of a small motel in the central U.S., and he removed wallpaper from dozens of rooms with no respiratory exposure, and he got severely ill. So one other thing we didn't mention is that there are what are called mycotoxins, which are toxins produced by molds, and those can cause problems. But usually has to be in high concentration and not just a little bit of exposure here and there.
Nathan, do you know if the mycotoxins are mostly or all in the fruiting bodies compared to microtoxins in the spores?
Not sure of that.
Yeah. I had heard that that's more of what happens in the fruiting body and not the spore, but we'll check into that.
What kind of medical issues are caused by the mycotoxins then?
Well, they can cause, depending upon what it is, nausea, vomiting, respiratory problems, and some of that gets to be concentration effects, even if the particular chemical is not a severe toxin. But there are many, many other chemicals that fall into that category where exposure to small amounts in most people doesn't really mean very much. But it's very easy in those circumstances to wear protective equipment, protecting eyes, nose, mouth, and wearing gloves.
And you often hear people say, well, you need to use some sort of solution that will kill the mold, adding, you know, Clorox or... And what's really the best way to treat it?
It depends what you mean by treat it, but you rarely need... Well, one, you don't need to kill mold to remove it. And killing it, but not removing it, doesn't totally solve the problem because dead mold particles can still cause allergic reactions and worsen people who have asthma that are also allergic to mold spores. The other thing that people forget is, what are you supposed to do with moldy materials when you take them out of a building? You don't send them to a special landfill. You don't really even have to contain it in any way. It's trash. Mm-hmm. And oh, by the way, we hope that there are molds or fungi working in landfill because they are the great breakers down of organic material. So, you don't need special bagging and, it's not asbestos. It doesn't go to a special landfill.
Interesting. Yeah.
And so if cleaning it is not always a great resolution, are we making an argument for removing the items whenever possible?
Depends what the materials are, because as like I said, if it's just on the surface of wood, it can be washed with soapy water and then make sure you allow it to dry before you cover it up.
Note to self.
Yeah.
Moisture comes up a lot in this conversation.
Nathan, was there a project you worked on that sort of stands out as remarkable because of the nature of the mold or the mystery of the mold?
I'm just going to put it in the context that when I was in building science and 2 years after that, I spent my time doing one of two things. One, telling builders when they had conditions that were horrible, such as gross mold growing in air ducts in the attics of a builder in Dallas, Fort Worth.
Yikes.
Telling him, I can't say for sure this is causing the problem of the child that's living in this, but this is a problem that's a result of design and operation failure, and you need to fix it. And then I would spend a lot of other time saying to homeowners who were usually trying to sue at that point that you're making a mountain out of a molehill. Yes, you got a little bit of mold in your house, but there's also mold in the leaves outside. You're not being realistic. But I do remember the one where, and this was also in either Houston or Dallas, where the owner-to-be was looking forward to carrying his bride through the threshold into this perfect house. This perfect house, of course, was all...
Isn't that a pre-wedding thought? Perfect. Sorry, come on.
No. It was... and there had been tremendous rain, so that everything was wet. It had a complicated wood, almost circular staircase that was going to be very hard to clean the surface mold off of. They could dry everything out and was going to be good. But what I finally said to the builder is, you are never going to make this buyer satisfied. Because you're not going to be able to provide him what he thinks he needs. And I said to the owner-to-be that you probably shouldn't be wanting to live where you are if you're that worried about mold. Two, you shouldn't be building everything out of wood when there are ways to minimize the amount of wood that's in the structure of the house. You're still going to have it, obviously, trim in other places. But, you know, there's a situation there where you're not going to be able as a builder to please the person.
Yeah.
Because their expectations are unrealistic.
So we're going to it's not going to be Pete's resource at the end of this podcast. It's going to be Nathan's, because the articles that Nathan wrote with Joe Stiebrick and Terry Brennan 20 years ago are still, you know, incredibly useful, still relevant, and they're for free on buildingscience.com. And so it's one of Nathan's legacy.
And the science hasn't
changed. Yeah.
And all you have to do on that site is under search is put in the word mold.
It's interesting. In their search, there's a suggested topics like air barriers, you know, concrete. There's one, mold. And if you click that one, all the articles Nathan, you know, co-authored are on there. I still use them all the time.
The other thing that's interesting, going back and rereading them and then doing a Google search last night and this morning, and one of them was on WebMD, which is not an authority, but has good information. And that their position, or at least the position of websites like that, has changed significantly in the last 20 years, not recommending mold testing, being much closer to what we said in our opinion part of those articles.
Interesting.
And there is just, you know, much less concern, for example, with black mold. It's like, oh, mold.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, the black mold thing was, I don't know how that, like, really took off. I understand that, like, a scary story that could be happening to every house in the United States sells real easy. And I understand that, like, a few people being very boisterous about the health problems that they're having can make things like that take off. But it, even at the time, I was like, man, is this really the problem that everybody is saying that it is? And since then, it's felt like even my clients understand that that was probably, for the most part, unreasonable.
And, you know, I had a client who was
overblown, not unreasonable.
Recently widowed. We had an extreme wedding event. Basement got wet. And where did the mold end up? In her attic. So she, with her insurance money, had a major company come in and do mold mitigation. And as soon as they completed this tens of thousands of dollars work, her insurance company dropped her because of the mold claim. And what happened? Because they didn't address the moisture problem in the basement, the mold came right back. And then she called me. So I'm in the position of, I'm sorry to tell you that the problem's in your basement. And if you don't solve that, you're just going to continue to have people come in and clean up the attic.
It's interesting that you said that, because I looked at a big apartment complex just outside New York City. And all of the attic problems were due to only in those buildings that had water in their crawl spaces. Mm-hmm. And the pathway was the 2 inches between the masonry firewalls and the framing.
Like a mold chase.
A mold chase. And what happened, and all of the buildings had been insulated recently with a lot of cellulose blown in. And so, but the only buildings that had the problem were the ones with water in the crawl space. Yeah,
interesting.
And the owner was a civil engineer. And so he was saying, well, shouldn't the insulators have known better? And I said, well, we can have that argument, but shouldn't the owners have known better? And furthermore, this gets to a contractual thing. What did you ask them to do? Did you ask them to do a building evaluation?
Or did you simply say, put some insulation
in the attic? There was nothing wrong with the insulation they put in the attic. And as proven by...
And they didn't probably go to the crawl space.
No. Why? That's not an insulator. That's not the insulator's primary responsibility. There are some insulators that are aware of the building science behind that and would say, well, you know, we need to make sure that we're not making things worse by putting the insulation in.
Yeah. So
really good.
So we're going to say, number one, we're going to worry about water. which is the
number two is worry about water. Number three is water about water. And then four would be airflow in the pathways that get the water where it's a problem.
And then if we find mold, we have to clean it, kill it, remove the items that are on it, or clean it or remove the substrate that it's living on. Right.
You don't need to kill it.
Yeah.
You need
because
to remove
even
it.
If you kill it, it's still in the environment.
It's still in the environment. And you need to solve the problem.
Mm. Yep. Worry about the water.
Yeah.
And then we need to be thinking of it along the lines of asbestos or lead. We need to be PPE. We need to be protecting our environment and protecting the spread of what we're using to other places in the home and all the things that you would normally do if you were renovating in a house where there were little kids living or something, you know.
I mean, in many ways, think of it as gypsum dust in terms of it's going to get everywhere if you don't control the process of getting out. And in fact, one interesting thing is that if the surface is really dry when you're going to remove it, then you generally want to spray it with a fine mist of water. Mm-hmm. Because that's going to keep it from getting airborne. Aerosolized as easily.
Great. So add a little bit of water to keep it from air transport. That's pretty cool. Right.
And then remove it.
Okay. Those are easy, like put a bow on it.
Thanks, brother.
Check's in the mail.
Yes. Yes. Okay. Thanks for listening to the podcast today. Like Peter just said, Nathan, thank you for joining us. If you have questions, it's questions@unbuilditpodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the YouTube channel, because outside of this Thursday podcast that comes out, there is other stuff publishing every Tuesday on the YouTube channel that is just video content. It's not audio content. And leave us a 5-star review on iTunes. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.
Bye.